podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. I'm Yaz Rana and with me today is the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, and the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker. Mark Butcher will be joining us over Zoom later, as will Georgie Heath, who will be giving us an update on the Fairbreak Invitational out in Dubai. Just before we started recording, the PCA released the following statement about Graham Thorpe. It read, "Graham Thorpe has recently fallen seriously ill and is currently in hospital receiving treatment. His prognosis is unclear at this stage and we ask for privacy for him and his family at this time. Our thoughts are with Graham and his family. Awful news, we echo those sentiments and we wish Graham a full recovery." When I spoke to Butch, who obviously spent the majority of his career playing with Thorpe at both Surrey and England, the news hadn't come through yet. First, let's talk about the county championship. Surrey and Hampshire were the only two sides to win in Division 1. They're currently first and second in the table, respectively. Lancashire have a game in hand in third place. They couldn't quite force a win on the final day against Warwickshire. There was also a high-scoring draw between Essex and Yorkshire at Chelmsford. On last week's show, Cricketviz analyst Ben Jones talked about how he still reckoned Dom Sibley and Rory Burns were the best two openers available for England selection in the country. They both scored hundreds. Sibley carried his bat against a very strong Lancashire attack featuring Hassan Ali, Matt Parkinson, Tom Bailey, Luke Wood, etc. I watched quite a lot of this knock, and I know that people have talked about Sibley working on his game through the winter. He's not had a big score yet. This was it. He carried his bat. But also you could see that he looks so different to when he played Test cricket. He's really side on, hit Hassan Ali through the covers quite a lot. His strengths were still his strengths, very comfortable leaving it, and he was very good through the leg side. Yeah, he was very good. You watch Rory Burns as well. He scored 100 here at the Oval.
I did see that innings, yeah. And similar in a way to Sibley, that Burns has gone away and looked at himself from a technical standpoint and fiddled on the margins a little bit, and he says that himself. It's not quite as pronounced as I've said on this show before, you know, the pre-trigger movements, the head bob to mid-wicket as if he's suddenly seen a starling or something just fly across the pitch, are not quite as pronounced as they were.
It's fair to say it wasn't a particularly fluent knock. We watched it here and he played and missed a lot outside off stump. Uncharacteristic kind of big swishes, which you don't usually see from Burns. Maybe that's a confidence in his game that's kind of not coming out in necessarily the right way at the moment. But obviously he ground it out as he's made a career out of and got to a century. And, you know, I think none of us would be surprised if he plays for England this summer, whether it's the first test or later on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, up until lunch, he was a bit crabby. He needed a score, Burns. You know, he hadn't passed 50 in any of the previous games. I think Surrey have played 5 games now, and I think his highest score was 44 before that 100. Same with Sibley, you know, they both needed a score, and it's a timely time to have got one with what we gather, the England squad to be announced this next week.
Yeah.
I thought the Sibley knock and the reaction around it was an interesting example of the impact of these live streams, and we've talked on the pod before that Lancashire have already gone all in with the kind of proper production with Bumble involved. Bumble's on there talking about Sibley looking a better player than he ever did when he was playing for England. You know, Wisden.com turned that into a story. We're talking about it now. It does the rounds and much quicker. That's not to say this wouldn't reach the England camp in previous years. Of course it would. But these things become a narrative much more quickly. And I think it means that things can change much more quickly as well. Sibley can go from being yesterday's man to being the man potentially in possession by the first test if he gets another 100. Because it's not just the runs, it's that people are talking about him and what he's changed and what he's worked on over the winter. And I think, that's something we haven't really had in county cricket until the last couple of years.
That's a really good point, because a few years ago, we're describing 200s there. You guys who watched the Burns 100 saying that he found life a little bit difficult at certain points. I'm saying the Sibley 100 was brilliant. A few years ago, not that many people could have made comments on both of those innings. You're either one or the other. Or they're just scores in the
players themselves say, well, it's a double-edged sword, you know, because when you play well, then you have people watching you. But you can't say, oh, I got a good one today anymore. You can't go home to your, you know, your dad or your wife or your kids or whatever and say, oh yeah, I couldn't have played that one when you know, it was just an average delivery outside off stump.
And you can't say you had a shocker every week as well because it's there in front of you.
No, indeed. Indeed. I mean, you've spoken about the numbers, haven't you, around streaming. Mm. And I think more needs to be looked into that, I think, generally from our perspective as hacks. And you've said yourself that while the services are improving and excellent in certain places and improving in others, still the numbers aren't necessarily driving home the benefits that they can offer terms of building the game up and putting it more in the shop window.
Yeah, I mean, two things. One, yeah, I don't think the numbers are that good yet. There were 580 people watching a free live stream of the New England captain batting in his fourth county championship match in 5 years. When he hit 34 runs in an over, which we'll get to later, there were a couple of thousand people, maybe 3,000 people watching a totally free live stream that anyone could watch in the world. But at the same time, the benefits for those who do watch it are so great that it opens it up to a new group of county fans. People have emailed the show before saying, like, what do you do if you're nowhere near a county? You can now watch it for free, which is a really good thing.
Also, and they are clipped up, though. Sorry,
that's what exactly what I was going to say. The live stream figures themselves, that's only part of the story, isn't
yeah.
it? People at work, however little work you do, it's quite hard to sit there and actually just watch a live stream unless you're working from home. Whereas the amount of people who watch those clips, the amount of people who will have watched Stokes hit was it 17 sixes that he
yeah.
hit? That will be enormous. And that's still doing a really good thing for county cricket, even if people aren't sitting there watching the whole of the lunch session before the first session before lunch.
Yeah.
Because they haven't got much to do at work.
No, that's definitely true. That's definitely true. There's a bit of news from Essex. Wicketkeeper bat Adam Wheater has announced that he will retire from the game at the end of the season.
How old did you say?
32.
Yeah.
He's had a very good career, averages more than 35 with the bat and part of this very successful era at Chelmsford. In the game at Chelmsford, there were a couple of hundreds for Alistair Cook, the first time he's ever scored hundreds in both innings of a first-class match, which I couldn't believe.
Is it really?
Yeah.
They're struggling, though.
Yes, I was going to say, I tipped them for the title. What's going on?
Last year was problems with the bat, scoring runs from top to bottom, and the same again is applying here. Cook has played well in patches. I'm not saying these are easy hundreds, but the first hundred he made against Kent on day one, Brown made another 100 as well at the other end, and it was a pretty pea-shooter style attack, to be honest. And these 200s that he's just made in this game just gone were important in the context of saving the game, or rather setting the game up, if you like, in the first innings. But the second innings was a kind of a dead game 100, you know, which is not to denigrate it, but his form has been in isolation, really. Obviously, Lawrence got injured. He's pulled a hamstring and wasn't really playing, wasn't putting the runs on the board beforehand. Wesley has been a bit in and out. They brought Paul Walter in, who's about 8'6".
He's been a star, hasn't he?
Tall Paul.
I love Paul Walter.
Yeah, well, he's one of these cricketers that is hard to define because he started as a sort of left-arm seamer, then he became a sort of stodgy batter, but
an important one.
Stodgy batter who can whack it miles and miles. Anyway, he finally made his first 100 last week. He's made a couple of 80s and 90s in the past.
Got a good record. He has
got a good record, but they've been very in and out. Brown has struggled since he made that 100 on the day one, and they're just not putting the runs on the board, Essex, really. Rossington has come in as the keeper, which is why I think Wheater has maybe decided to call it a day. Critchley's been a bit in and out again, and weirdly, Simon Harmer can't take a wicket.
Mm.
So I don't know what his figures are, his stats are, but every time I look up, Harmer's 0 for 70, 1 for 85.
He's 2 for 150 this week.
Yeah, there you go. And yet, the majority have been played at Chelmsford, where, you know, obviously, traditionally, they would prepare pitches to suit him. Naturally, it's early season. But it's problems, yeah, alarm bells for Essex, to be honest, because the tried and trusted formula that's worked for them over the last few years is not really playing out at the moment. Still early days. The team that's impressed me the most, I think, is probably Lancashire. But again, if you pick those, you name those three or four sides that were up the top, Yorkshire, Lancashire, Surrey, Hampshire, they are four very good cricket teams. And, you know, they stand up against any of the good cricket sides, any of the good county sides of this century, I think, really. I think the standard at the top is as good as it's been in a long time.
I think the quality of the overseas players has a part in that.
Two overseas players makes such a massive difference.
And this influx of Pakistanis as well, like really high, world-class players coming in both divisions as well. I think just, yeah, the strength and depth in the two divisions is really strong at the moment. Just on that Essex-Yorkshire game, there's another 100 for Harry Brook, who now averages about 150 in Division 1. We'll talk about him more later. There's an 87 for Dawid Milan as well. In Division 2, Ben Stokes had some fun. It was just his fourth county championship match in 5 years. He hit 161 of 88 deliveries, a knock that included an all-time county championship record of 17 sixes in an innings. He hit 18-year-old left-arm spinner Josh Baker for 34 and over, the last ball of that over bouncing about 10 feet just inside the rope. That was good fun to watch. And there was, I think Rory Dollard, the journalist, he was there for the first day of that game where Stokes did nothing, and then he wasn't there for the second day.
Still prompted Kevin Peterson to call for the culling of all county cricket, basically. It's a very unfortunate situation we found ourselves in when anyone does anything good, then it's immediately turned into a negative, because to be able to do it in the first place only shows that county cricket is so poor. It's a really depressing starting point for anything. And also, his point was that, you know, this Worcestershire side is so, so bad that anyone could have scored those runs, right? Or, you know, you didn't have to be that good a player to smash them around. Well, that Worcestershire side drew the game. They weren't wiped. It's not, they weren't playing like a university team. They were playing on a very good pitch, sure, but that's also what we've asked for, right? So it's just, sometimes you just feel like county cricket really can't win. Whatever happens, yeah, there will be a way.
Promising left arm spinner, given a go early on. You know, all these things are meant to be laudable things.
And you're meant to be playing against the best, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, he's got absolutely spanked Josh Baker, but that's probably going to stand him in good stead. I mean, you know, it could break him, but more than likely it will stand him in good stead. And he's had experience of playing against the best.
And Stokes has done similar to this against Australia, South Africa, West Indies, you name them. Peterson quite often tweets things that I don't think are that well thought through, and he puts them on Twitter. They're deliberately provocative, and you can just get so used to them you kind of ignore them. But this one actually irritated me. I think it was really irresponsible for him. He's a pundit who gets paid a lot of money to give views on cricket. He should know before he tweets that out that Worcestershire are missing three first team regulars. No Dylan Pennington, no Charlie Morris, and no Josh Tongue. This was not Worcestershire's first choice team, and all those points. Of course he wouldn't. But
he shouldn't be
tweeting that out without that knowledge. And also, as Joe, you say, Worcestershire end up drawing that game. So, and Ben Stokes, who
with a brilliant unbeaten 100 from a young lad called Jack Haynes.
Jack Haynes, yeah.
Who people think a lot of. Yeah, but that doesn't come under Peterson's nose, you know, because he's only interested in himself.
Ben Stokes went wickedless in that game as well, you know.
And he bowled a lot of overs as well, by the way.
And we know that Ben Stokes is a very good bowler at test level. So, yeah, that annoyed me. There were a couple of hundreds in that game for Sean Dixon, who's now the leading run scorer in the country. I think that's the first time I've ever mentioned Sean Dixon.
Right,
on
who
the
had him for 1,000 runs?
Well, he got about a third of them in one knock a few years ago, didn't he? He got a triple century.
Yeah.
Almost got Kent's record score. Seems a very odd player in that he seems to have quite streaks where he doesn't get any runs at all. And then when he gets in, he's just impossible to get out.
Exactly this. I think I saw a stat a couple of years ago when he was still at Kent where he's got an unbelievable record once he gets to 20. So one of the best records in the country. Just he has a lot of failures in there too.
A bit like me.
how many triple unders have you got? He is a South African-born opener who is now 30. And yeah, as Joe mentioned, has a first-class triple 100 to his name from his time at Kent.
You interviewed Matty Potts from Durham,
who's
probably the standout quick so far from English quick from the second division.
Yeah, I mean, arguably in both divisions. It's his third six-foot of the summer. All of them have been in really high-scoring games. He takes a lot of wickets that are bowled or LBW, gets top-order batters out. He's very interesting to speak to. So he broke into the Durham first team at about 18. He was quite skinny, quite wiry. He's put on a lot of weight, muscle. He's injured in 2017-18. And he's not rapid. He probably bowls about 83, 84, 85 miles per hour. But his just attitude about how to bowl on flat wickets is just quite encouraging and good to hear. He says you've got to get absolutely everything that the pitch has to offer. Hit the pitch really hard. He's learnt from bowling with Carse, Wood and Stokes at Durham, as well as Rushworth, who helped him develop his wobble seam balls. I think he's really exciting. I read in the Times that he was a non-travelling reserve for the T20 series in West Indies. So I wouldn't be surprised if he plays in that Netherlands ODI series that takes place during the New Zealand Test series. He's only 23, so he's a couple of years younger than Fisher and Mahmood, so I think he's definitely one to watch.
Yeah, it feels like he's been around for a little while already. He's played a lot of T20 cricket, hasn't he? And yeah, I spoke to Scott Borthwick, Durham's captain, before the start of the season for a general piece about Durham, and he picked out Potts and said he has never seen, I mean, but Borthwick's been playing for what, kind of 12 years or so now. He's never seen anyone work harder in training, never seen a fitter county cricketer, so he just gives it absolutely everything. And that's a bloke who's played a lot of cricket with Ben Stokes, who's kind of a legendary trainer. So he's obviously got plenty about him. It'll be interesting to see if he can make that step up. Those figures against Worcestershire in that match were extraordinary.
He had a spell against Notts where, again, Notts scored loads of runs, but he's got, I think, the first four wickets to fall and three of them were bowled. Like, he's getting good players out. He's very, very exciting, I think. Anna asks, listening to last week's podcast and the lengthy conversation on potential England openers, Sam Robson didn't even get a passing mention. I realise it was before his latest big score, but I'm just emailing in to check he's not a ghost or a figment of my imagination.
We weren't on the show, Joe.
We weren't on the show. And also, Ben picked Sam Robson out as one of his ones to watch for the season, and I think you weren't here.
Okay. Yes.
And I gave him a load of grief for it.
Yeah. Well, I think there was more that we kind of know what Sam Robson's about. So he was a slightly odd one to watch to pick out. Apart from the fact, you know, those opening slots are still very much up for grabs, as we'll come on to. He did very well in a very poor Middlesex side last year. He's now doing well in a good Middlesex side that topped Division 2. In defence, in our defence to Anna, which is a reasonable point, Robson hadn't got 100 until this 100.
And we can confirm that he's not a ghost as well.
We can confirm he's not a ghost, absolutely.
He is one of the many, though, that you do wonder what could have happened if England had stuck by them a little bit longer, given them another series. I think Adam Live falls into that category as well. You know, players have their moments, but they're quite fleeting. And once your moment is gone, then it's very, very hard to come back into the conversation. And then you players tend to settle into the perception or the persona, if you like, that we've created for them. Somebody like Live, to me, had the ability to make a mark. And Robson, at the time, people were very excited about Sam Robson as a player with the technical components to play back foot cricket, obviously having grown up in Australia. And before we knew it, I mean, he made 100, didn't he? But and then before we knew it, he was gone.
He averaged 30.
And yeah, this is it.
We'd kill for that now, wouldn't we?
This is it. But back then, there was that sense where we have, if not an embarrassment of riches, then we have plenty to pick from. And so the window of chance was smaller than it appears to be now. And so there's a number of these players that carry with them a question mark, what could have been, and I think he's definitely one of them.
Robson, he was particularly unfortunate because he, when he finished his second series of the summer here, was against India?
Yeah.
There wasn't an assumption that he would be dropped, but England didn't actually play another test match for a long time, didn't play until the Caribbean the next February or March, I think, by which time Lyth had stacked up 100 after 100 for Yorkshire, and Trott had come back on the scene. So Robson wasn't so much kind of axed as just sort of pushed to one side. It was slightly different to other openers, who you'd get to the point where you just think they're not going to score test runs at the moment. We've got to move them on. So I think he has been a bit unlucky. He's also, I've chatted to him quite a bit over the years, he is one of the nicest cricketers out there. And I don't know if that has necessarily helped him. He's very self-effacing. He talks openly about the struggles he had in test cricket. Whereas normally players say, you know, are slightly bitter about what happened and sort of plainly desperate for another chance. I'm sure Robson is desperate for another chance, but he was very considered in why he got dropped. Yeah, I don't see any interviews of him saying, I'm desperate to open the batting for England again, because I don't think that's really his character. But Pete Hanscom is captain at Middlesex, the Aussie international, is banging the drum for Robson, said it's absolutely time for another conversation about him. So I hope that does it, Anna. Yeah, we haven't forgotten about him.
Well, I saw him, he scored 100 on the opening game of last season against Somerset. I thought he'd look like a test player in that against a really good Somerset attack. In kind of England's defence of why he's not played since he first played in 2014, he's just not put together an amazing season. He's had lots of seasons where he's averaged about 40, and that's just probably not enough to kind of get your name back truly in the conversation. He's not made selectors really sit back and notice what he's done. Maybe he can do it that this season, but I think we had a similar conversation about him last summer, and I think he just needs to score a couple more hundreds to really get his name there. I mean, his knock this week, by the way, was brilliant. He scored 149 as Middlesex chased 370 from 74 overs at Hove. Runs for Hanscom, Holden and Anderson as well in that run chase.
Poor old Sussex, though.
Yeah, I didn't even think it was that generous a declaration.
No, you know,
370 off 74 overs. They need to go pretty much
just an absolute belter of a pitch at home, which is exactly what Ian Salisbury has called for, and he thinks that's the way you're going to produce cricketers, but it does leave you open to this kind of thing, unfortunately.
Yeah.
They got some criticism for that declaration, which I thought was very harsh. Yeah, they're trying to, you know, bring forward pressure cricket. They're trying to put their young kids in difficult situations. And they're also trying to put on a show on a Sunday afternoon when the sun's out at Hove. That, as you say, that declaration, you know, it's hardly kind of kamikaze stuff, was it? And all right, you know, if they're lacking a little bit in the bowling side, then so be it. You know, you still have to try and live a little, you know. And I thought that the criticism that came their way, I said, you sometimes wonder just what people want from this game. You know, what if they'd batted on through the afternoon, then they'd have got slated for that as well.
Yeah.
You know.
They declared when they were four down in the second innings with Pujara unbeaten on 170, his 400.
Well, he might have got 1,000 that afternoon if he was allowed to carry on.
Ollie Robinson returned to the side in that game, his first game of the season. He took a 5 from the first innings and a couple in the second innings.
So what's been wrong with him? Some dental problem?
Yeah, genuinely. That kept him out of the two games before that. So,
do you know any more than that?
No, other than it was something to do with his teeth.
Right.
That's not more, that's just the
that's
same
more,
repackaged
no.
information.
Toothless attack.
But when people say that Robinson's got fitness issues, he may well do, but that's not why he's not been playing this season.
Okay.
Elsewhere in the country, there was a win for Glamorgan over Leicester in Cardiff. Solid all-round team performance runs for Carlson and North East. Middlesex are currently top. Glamorgan are in second, having played a game more than Notts in third and a game more than Mickey Arthur's Derbyshire, who are in fourth, doing pretty well at the moment. Phil, lots of runs still. Is it the pitches, the weather, or is it the balls?
Yeah, nicely done. So I played my first game on Saturday, Yaz, and we used the same Duke's balls that they use in county cricket, and I could not believe what was in my hand. Did I mention this to you, Joe? It's amazing. It's like those wind balls. Remember those orange wind balls where there's a tiny little
dent.
A dent going round the middle of it. And that is the extent of the seam. I could not believe it. Now, in our game, whatever, you know, it's just silly cricket. But these balls are possibly fit for purpose as replicas, if you like, of Kookaburra cricket balls. But they can only be a key reason why we are seeing scores go north. And this is not necessarily a criticism, but it was really stark. We've always used Duke's cricket balls at our level, and they are the components are completely different. You know, obviously the proud seam on previous Duke's balls has been completely or almost entirely eradicated. So this has to be a very, very key reason.
And this was the exact ball that they're using in Championship
cricket.
Yeah,
Duke's ball, Championship standard,
right.
Duke's balls. Yeah.
Mm.
It's amazing.
There's a report in the Times that said pretty much exactly the same thing.
Right.
And I spoke to someone at one of the counties who'd said very similar as well. So it does sound like that is one of the reasons.
Yeah, certainly as well, consciously, groundsmen are... Well, firstly, it's easier, I think, to prepare pitches at the start of the season because you have a bigger run-up to it and you can plan how you plot your square. And certainly the evidence at the Oval and elsewhere has been that a little bit more life has been injected into these pitches, which produces good cricket. The games here at the Oval have been superb. And no doubt about it, it's a boring and hackneyed point, but this is absolutely essential to the future of Red Bull cricket at domestic level, international level and world level. Get the tracks right. Rob Key was saying this in a very interesting interview that Nasser Hussain got with him on Sky. I don't know if you've seen this. Have you seen it, Joe?
No.
So I saw it last night. Really, really well worth a watch. I imagine it will be available as a podcast or vodcast as well for people who don't have Sky. And Key's very polished, of course, and he's a natural broadcaster, of course, but he didn't duck any of the questions either, and he was very good and upfront about it. And again, he was talking about the pitches, you know, and just how central they are. And he wasn't bagging them either. He wasn't, because it's too easy, I think, in the media to say, pitches are terrible. You know, the Butch line. It's a bit more complicated than that. And groundsmen have a tough job. But getting through to producing pitches with life is absolutely the be-all and end-all, I think, to producing good cricket, because it's not that there is a complete dearth of talent out there, but if you are flogging yourself on dead tracks or overly juicy tracks, then it produces, in the end, cricket that is ill-fitting for the highest levels.
Yeah, and can I do my moment of the week?
Yeah.
Because it sort of ties into this. So I chatted to Daniel Bell-Drummond at Kent, who I've always found a fascinating cricketer. He's was talked about from his teens as going to be... I think Rob Key actually tipped him for 100 test caps, and Bell-Drummond...
Still might, then.
Still, he's 28, so better get cracking.
He's really
old. Yeah. He's only 28.
Very talented player.
And he was named Wisden School's Cricket of the Year in... I can't remember what year. So he... To put it bluntly, hasn't really achieved what was expected of him. But he was interesting about this because he says, actually looking at his career, he wouldn't take any of his seasons back, because in every season bar one, he has been delighted with the way he's gone in red ball or white. What he's struggled to do is do both at the same time. And that, he's not alone in that. 2016, he had a stunning season. He scored 2,000 runs just under in all competitions, averaged 50 and above in all three competitions, averaged 64 in the championship. So, you know, he'd be playing for England if he'd done that at the right time. Since then, he's done one or the other. So last 2 years, he was the top English run scorer in the Blast last year, as Kent won the title. Year before that, he was the top run scorer in the Blast, had two rubbish Red Bull seasons. And he said, with a bit of frustration, I'm kind of judged as a Red Bull player because that's what I was thought about. So people talk about my Red Bull slump, but they don't really talk about how good when he's going in white ball, partly because those England spots aren't really available. Now, at the start of this season, he scored 200s, one against a very, very good Hampshire attack, 149 against a very good Hampshire attack, and he scored 100 at Headingley. And there is this sense that his record, I think, looking at his year-by-year record, I haven't done exactly the stats, is significantly better in Div 1 than it is Div 2. And he talks about losing faith in his technique, playing on not very good pitches, then the kind of demons get in your head and the whole thing unravels over a course of a season. Now, Kent are back in Division 1 after the kind of conference-based system, and yeah, he's reeled off a couple of hundreds. So there is some, you know, it's an easy thing. People can say, well, he's making excuses, and that wasn't really how it came across. He was acknowledging that he has failed himself to be as consistent as he wants to, but there are also reasons for it. And, you know, he's probably one of the most talented uncapped stroke makers in this country. Certainly in terms of talent, if not necessarily the numbers in Red Bull. But I think
unwittingly you might have touched on again why he possibly didn't get a go. Firstly, bad luck, bad timing. Timing is so much a part of this. You're talking earlier about Robson, and Ben Duckett is another one who, you know, timing was a bit off for him, and now he's scoring good runs. But I think you touched on it. Stroke maker, opening batsman, wristy, stroke maker. Also not at a so-called big club, so not making consistently high profile runs, but a stroke maker. And there has always been that sense with Bell-Drummond that if he gets in, you want to watch him right up there as a player to watch. But because we have these kind of rather dull preconceptions about what English cricketers need to look like and play like in whichever positions they happen to find themselves in, there's that kind of sense with Bell-Drummond, probably unfairly, but that, you know, there's a flightiness to him, there's a wristiness to him that might not be the right kind of minerals for Test match cricket and all of that. But the record, as you say, is considerably stronger than many players who have got the go.
Yeah,
I actually can't believe he's 28.
Yeah, I mean, through me as well.
I can't believe. I would have presumed he's 31, 32. He's been around for years.
And I think what you say, Phil, has been reflected. He's moved up and down the order in Red Bull.
Right, yeah.
They've tried him as a sort of middle-order stroke maker because that suits his kind of game a bit better. He started the season as an opener, failed a couple of times, is now at three.
Okay, right. So he's at three now.
Yeah,
okay.
Which he said he's comfortable with. But, I mean, he is traditionally an opener, but yeah, he probably hasn't necessarily got the kind of game that you need to be an opener in English conditions. If he took the
no
step
one does.
Up. who does? Darryl Mitchell.
Everyone's a number five.
He's obviously doing, as you say, had a couple of really good blasts recently, but I wonder if he falls into the category a bit like Duckett, actually, where his best format might be 50 over cricket. So he's not actually getting the opportunity to.
He's certainly got a good record in that.
Yeah. And just going back to your point on pitches, Phil. Going back to pots, I think the pitches at the moment, or whether it's the balls or the pitches,
take wickets.
The proper bowlers who could do a job in Test cricket, I think, are standing out. And I think, you know, look, the two leading wicket takers in the country, Potts and Hassan Ali. You got some really high quality bowlers up there, and a lot of the guys, your usual suspects, I guess, who've been averaging about 15 the last few years, haven't been doing quite as well this season. Well,
Darren Stevens been dropped by Kent, wasn't he?
Yeah, I was about to come on to Stevens, actually. Kent played a first-class game this week against the Sri Lanka Development 11, who are over here touring, and Darren Stevens, age 46, hit 168, his 38th first-class 100.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how I felt about this game. How old are these Sri Lankans?
Young. Only one first-class debut.
Right, okay.
They're not an A team, but they're not just kids either. Anyway, over at the Wisden shop, we felt it was the right time to acknowledge Darren Stevens' remarkable career. So we've launched a t-shirt and poster called The Curious Case of Darren Stevens, available exclusively at the Wisden shop. Head to wisden.com/shop to check that out. Phil, what's your moment of the week?
I've got loads, but I'll just take one.
Mark Waugh was the one I was going for.
Mark Waugh, yeah. My all-timer. You know, my north, my south, my east, my west, Mark Waugh, who I first saw bat in 1989 as a nine-year-old kid. I was, and I saw him bat Chelmsford when he was playing a bemulleted young Mark Waugh playing for Essex. He hadn't yet played international cricket. He joined Essex, I think, as a 21 or two-year-old in 1988, took over from Alan Border, and he was my first real cricket crush, if you like. And since then, of course, you know, he had a great career, 120 odd test matches for Australia, the greatest slip fielder of all time, certainly right up there, wore his collar up, wore his cable knit at all times, and was a dream to watch, you know, and a few players have got near to him, but probably as a right-handed player, no one's quite touched the levels that he reached. So an objectively beautiful cricketer and brilliant cricketer, but also something that was quite, a bloke that was quite special to me, really. Anyway, at midnight on Sunday night, him and I had a chat over the phone. He's over in Sydney. And I wouldn't say I was nervous, but I was a bit apprehensive because he sort of has a reputation. He doesn't suffer fools, and I probably am one, and I certainly am one at midnight on a Sunday night. But it was a really good conversation that we had, and we had a chat for about 40 minutes or so. It was a lot about the Essex years. So he played in that incredibly successful side that Gooch ran. I think he certainly won two championships. And then we spoke about his time through the 90s, playing for Australia as well. And so it was a classic sort of nostalgia trip, but there was some interesting stuff as well about the game today and about the test match game and how it needs to grow and survive and so on and so on. So it was not a particularly revelatory interview, but it was just a special thing for me.
You need to stop saying that about the interviews you've done. You said that last, I can't remember what the last one was as well. You need to say they are revelatory, even if they're not. That's how it works.
It was revelatory to me just to hear the bloke's voice. And I asked him about style, actually. And I just didn't believe him. Because I've asked cricketers this about style before, those who have it. And they always say it's accidental. But I've never believed anyone less than Mark Waugh. And he was talking about growing up with Stephen, as he calls him. Always Stephen. And he said that his brother, Stephen, he got increasingly pissed off with it because Steve Waugh became pigeonholed as crabby, functional was the actual word that he used, and rigid was the other word that Mark Waugh used. And he said, and I got labelled as the sort of elegant, lazy one and all of that. But you could hear in his voice that now all the dust has settled and Steve Waugh might have his average at 50 and Mark Waugh might have his average at 42, but we know who's won that battle in the end. We know that Junior has taken the plaudits. And you could hear it in his voice. And I just sort of let him speak and then said, I don't believe you. And then he just sort of giggled and laughed. And
yeah, you say that though, saying that Mark won, but a lot of particularly younger listeners, they look at the record, people talk about Steve more. What Mark doesn't come up on Sky commentary discussions as much as Steve does, and yeah, he's not remembered.
But again, this is when we fall into the trap of just looking at raw numbers at the expense of the real stuff, the poetry, the artistry. Mark Waugh was a dreamboat cricketer, and also made a lot more tougher runs than he's often given credit for. You know, he made proper fourth innings runs. What he didn't do was go big. He made a lot of hundreds, but he just didn't go big. He made 150 in Test cricket. And considering you're batting four for Australia in the greatest team ever made, you should at least be selfish at some point. But he just didn't. He made lots and lots of hundreds, adorning innings where others went big. I mean, you know, Shane Warne used to call Steve Waugh the most selfish cricketer ever made, you know, which is meant as a criticism, but also a sort of backhanded compliment, I suppose.
It's also a stunning one-day opener as well, wasn't he? In a way that I don't know if necessarily gets the credit, because people always talk about Gilchrist, Jayasuriya, but he was doing pretty much the same thing and had side that won pretty much every game.
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, he made 300s in the 96 World Cup. Him and Gilchrist changed the game along with, obviously, Jayasuriya. You know, they opened the batting for Australia and did things that people weren't really doing. And Waugh was one of the greats. He also hit the biggest sixes of them all. Now, again, you wouldn't have associated Mark Waugh with hitting big sixes necessarily, but Ian Healy says Mark Waugh always hit the biggest sixes, and there is some footage of him hitting one, I forget what ground it is in Australia, it might be Perth, but he hits, I think, Daniel Vettori out of the ground, and, you know, it's a legendary shot. And again, it was all touch and timing. He was well built, but he wasn't a big bloke as such, but just a joy. So I interviewed him on Sunday night, I interviewed Marnus Lavershane on Thursday or so last week. That was good fun, a really interesting bloke, actually.
Makings of a good top four there.
Yeah. Both of which appear in the upcoming issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly.
It comes out next week. On Waugh, is there your love of Dan Lawrence? That's totally unrelated to your love of Mark Waugh. There's no overlap there.
There's probably some sort of shared sensibility. Yeah, I think so. But my love for Dan Lawrence is based as much on his personality as his ever watchably flaky stylings at number four or five. There's probably some sort of theme at work there. Yeah, but just briefly on Lavershane, you know, a lot of layers at work there in a player that is easily sort of pigeonholed, I think, and maybe slightly lampooned, but really engaging fella, spoke very interestingly about the role that his faith plays in his cricket, and how he feels in effect that something beyond his control is at work, a form of destiny, if you like, that is, if not controlling his career, then certainly something is at work beyond the trajectory of simple runs and wickets. He spoke very interestingly about that, and also more straightforwardly about his utter obsession with the game. And again, it struck me that the really, really, really good players, sure, they have amazing hand-eye coordination and all the rest of it, but they have to live the thing. And he does. And he says he gets withdrawal symptoms if he doesn't bat. He says he can't cope with it. He says if he has a week off, then that's enough, and he needs to get back. He needs to get and have a hit. I spoke to his coach as well, Neil DaCosta, who's very interesting on him, and he said when he first came across Marnus Lavershane, he was working, he was a part-time cricketer. He'd lost his contract at Queensland. He was a part-time cricketer, and he had a sugar addiction. He had some form of attention deficit. He had very highs, very, very big highs, very low lows, and was unhealthy, in effect, mentally unhealthy. And DaCosta got hold of him, and they drew up a new approach, a new physical approach, in effect, that he would hope would then bleed into his cricket, which took place. And this idea of a sugar addiction, it's not particularly well discussed, you know, especially in sport. But he said he had great metabolism, so it didn't show in his body, but he would have real concentration problems, and he would shoot high and then he would nosedive, and he kept getting to 30 odd on a buzz after three teas in his coffee before he goes out there, and then hitting a low, and then he couldn't concentrate, and then he was just kept getting out at grade cricket level, kept getting out and out and out after an hour's batting, having played really well up to that point. And so they addressed all of that at that point. And now you've got to bear in mind, this is the number one player in the world, number one test player in the world, who was striving to get back on the circuit at 21. He'd lost his contract at Queensland. He was out. He was done. He was part-time working.
Just playing test cricket not that long after.
And then playing test cricket four years later, and then the number one player in the world 6 years later. So remarkable story, really. And he told it really well. It was a tough one to get hold of, as Joe will know. I mean,
yeah, he really made you work for it. It was kind of like he was just leaving you alone repeatedly, wasn't he? every time you called,
no run,
letting it pass off stump.
But you, I think you might have thought, because I kept having to say to you, no, it didn't happen. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. That possibly
I'm used to that.
Yeah, sure. But possibly that he was, you know, as you cricketers of a certain level, they maybe play you a little bit, you know. But there wasn't any sense of that with him. It's just that he was living his life at 100 miles an hour.
Busy batting.
This is it, yeah. And we finally got each other.
Just to add as well, that Labuschagne interview is part of a feature on the next Fab Four, as we've identified them. Now, we won't reveal them all. You can probably guess another one of them.
But you won't guess the fourth.
We can discuss that in a bit more depth next week. You can tell us how silly we are. But that's been quite fun to put together.
England are reportedly selected their squad for the first New Zealand test after the upcoming round of county championship fixtures. I spoke to Mark Butcher earlier to get his thoughts about who he'd like to see in that first squad. Butcher, the next week or so, England, currently without both the head coach and a national selector, will be selecting a squad for the first test of the summer against New Zealand. It's reported to be a 17-man squad, which is a lot for a home series. We know that Root's going to bat four. We know that Stokes is going to bat six. We know that Broad and Anderson are likely going to be back if they're fit. Who would you like to see come in from a batting point of view to occupy slots at three, occupy a slot at five?
I'm not sure that three and five are the only places that are open, are they? You know, Zach Crawley's finished off after making the 100 in the Caribbean and Antigua, sort of finished off pretty miserably in that series, and has not got off to a fabulous start at the beginning of the. Well, in fact, that's understatement of the year. He's averaging 17, I think, in the championship so far. So, you know, there's an argument to say that somebody else should be walking out and opening the batting with Alex Leeds at the beginning, presuming that he maintains his spot on the side, which I think he should. I think he certainly deserves another five or six test matches to go with the three that he played in the West Indies. So what are we looking at? I mean, Harry Brook's gone off like a house on fire for Yorkshire. What's he averaging? 150 or something. Yeah. So I mean, he's definitely in form. Darren Millan would be the obvious. You know, going back to kind of things that I've said over the past in terms of, you know, making the England team sort of more resilient, less brittle or whatever. Darren Millan's got off to a fabulous start. He'd be the perfect fit, I suppose, at number three, if you didn't want to throw one of the youngsters, either sort of uncapped players like Bohannon or Brook into that spot at number three. So I would have no issue with that. And at number five, I mean, you know, it's difficult to say that Johnny Bairstow doesn't deserve to stay in that team. You know, he was very happy batting at six, I know, because I spoke to him in the Caribbean. But given that his captain wants to bat there, Johnny would have no issue, I suppose, in going up to batting at number five. And I think, again, he deserves to maintain that spot in the team. Now, you know, there's going to be a lot of chat around, well, should we just go back to Bairstow, keep him wicket and batting at seven and et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure that will be something that will be on the table, albeit that it certainly wasn't Rob Key's favoured thing to do back in the day. But I think, again, Ben Folkes deserves his chance to start. He's averaging 100 in the championship with the bat. He didn't have a great time of it with the gloves in the Caribbean, which is a slight concern. But I still think that he deserves to get a run of test matches at home. Mm. So for me, he stays at seven. Bairstow moves up to five. And some of those younger players have to wait it out a little bit longer to score more runs. But, you know, I think that the two compelling cases really would be Bohannon and Brook at the moment. And, of course, you got Ollie Pope's averaging 60 again. You know, there are all of the usual suspects sort of bubbling around in that batting lineup.
We could have quite a similar looking top seven as we did in the Caribbean then.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing for me, the whole thing in the Caribbean, Joe Root moving up to from 4 to 3 was an interesting one, because that seemed to be, people seemed to like that because it made more room for other younger players to sort of to fill in around in the slightly lower spots. But it was always my thought that Joe Root was doing that, not because he felt it was the best thing for Joe Root, but because he was trying anything that he possibly could to make the rest of the batting lineup work. I think we're now back in a position where he is at number 4, and the other players have to come in I'm still very much of the opinion that more experience in that team is better than less. You put inexperienced players into a winning team, not a losing one, and I stand by that.
Just moving on to the bowlers, then Chris Wokes is reportedly going to miss the first Test at Leith. He's not going to be fit enough for Warwickshire's next game in the County Championship, and that's when the squads are going to be selected. Sam Curran's not really bowling for Surrey. He bowled a little bit earlier on in the season, but hasn't bowled since. So we're going to have one of the same problems that we had last summer, where there's not really an obvious person to bat 8. Ollie Robinson came into the side as someone who could potentially do that, but it's quickly become apparent that number 8 is at least one spot too high for him. Yeah. And there's no Moeen Ali in the test frame this summer. He was there last summer. So there's not an obvious spinner to occupy number 8. Who do you think should be in that group of bowlers, bearing in mind one of them's going to have to bat 8?
Well, I'm not too worried about number 8, to be honest. That again is going to have to be something that gets sorted out from within once the best bowlers and best batters have been picked. Mm. Again, we've tied ourselves up in knots for years trying to pick the. Obviously, you don't want the sort of tail that we had back in 1999. and some listeners will remember what that looked like, and others won't. But I think Ed Giddins might not have been number 11, if I'll give you an idea, or Phil Tufnell might not have been number 11. That'll give you an idea. So Anderson and Broadbent playing more than likely. I'd like to see Saqib Mahmood keep his place in the side. I'd like to see Matt Parkinson given a go. Obviously Parkinson and Jack Leach will end up being part of that 17-man squad. Be fabulous after the start that Parkinson's had. In fact, the start he's had over the last couple of summers, really, in Championship cricket, where he's taken wickets and been reasonably economical as well, albeit with the odd spell where he gets taken. But I think he deserved it, and I think for England to have some sort of point of difference, and it isn't going to be extreme pace because obviously Mark Wood and Jofra Archer are not available at the moment. Leg spin would be a great place to start. So I don't think it's going to, again, it's not going to be wildly different from anything that we've seen, but it'd be fabulous for Saqib to get another test match. I think he was really impressive in the West Indies. Play alongside the two old stages. And then, of course, Ollie Robinson is back playing again, but Craig Overton, who finished off in the Caribbean and was pretty ineffectual, I suppose, on those flat decks. But he started off like a house on fire with 22 wickets at 14. And out of the rest of them, he'd be a guy perhaps that might be able to get up to the dizzy heights of number 8. The whole thing's pretty imperfect at the moment, isn't it? And what you're looking for is for some players to be selected, to be stuck with, but to stand up and actually back up that faith that hopefully the new regime will show in them over a period of time. And then you can start making informed decisions based on what is actually being done out in the middle, rather than guessing what might happen based on what's gone on in the Championship at the beginning.
A lot of people will be listening to this. I don't know what the right word is, but I guess they'd be hoping for you to have said more new names. England haven't done that well recently. And when someone who hasn't played before comes in, there's an element of hope. You don't know much about them and you hope they might be better than they actually are. People don't watch a huge amount of county cricket. Even with the streams, people generally watch highlights rather than actually watching a whole day's play. And those highlights can be quite misrepresentative. So I guess it could be quite a difficult summer for England. You've got a group of players who haven't won many test matches. It could be quite a similar group. I mean, Rob Key this week actually said to expect quite a similar group. New Zealand are a good side. and it's a team that's lost a lot of test matches playing it, a side that's won a lot of test matches. So Rob Key and Ben Stokes, everyone seems to genuinely agree they've said most of the right things so far as captain and managing director, but things could quite quickly become quite difficult for them.
They could, yeah. I mean, but if you look at what England have done over the last 5 years or so, they've picked a hell of a lot of new players, a lot of new names, tons of them all over the place, whether it be opening the batting, middle order, new bowlers. And none of that has translated into the sort of consistency in terms of simple results that a cricketing nation with the resources that we have would reasonably expect. So, look, I can fall into the same trap as a lot of other people with sort of like being excited about having people you've never seen before. But England are not looking for sort of like magical fixes. They're looking for a team that doesn't fall over and have its tummy tickled every time it gets under pressure. That's what we're doing at the moment. Mm. You know, and if the people who have listened to the podcast before, I've been very, very consistent on this. You have to stop being a pushover before you can start being exciting, or you can start doing some of the more fun and indulgent things of picking youngsters and throwing them all in and having them go out and try and score at four and over, and you know what I mean, all of that kind of stuff. It's you have to learn to walk before you can run, and England are very much in the walking extremely slowly stages at the moment.
Thanks for your time, Butch. Chat to you next week.
Okay, no problem.
On last week's show, Ben Jones gave us the data view on what the England top seven should look like. I've asked Phil and Joe to pick 12-man squads, even though it's been reported that there'll be up to 17 selected initially.
That's madness.
This will be more fun. This will be more fun, I think. Joe, let's start with you.
How similar are they, by the way? I haven't seen Phil's.
They're pretty similar. Mine's the most different. Mine's the odd one out, I guess. But do you want to go first?
Groupthink, Joe.
What's the problem when you spend too much time together? I'll try and remember off the top of my head. Crawley, Lees, Bohannon, Root, Brook, Stokes, Bairstow, Keeping. And then the bowlers, we picked a 12. So the pace bowlers are Anderson, Broad, Robinson, Saqib Mahmood, and then Matt Parkinson is my spinner.
Cool.
Worth saying, by the way, Chris Wokes is reported to miss the first test match and Sam Curran isn't yet bowling, so not...
Yeah,
not...
I probably wouldn't have picked either of them, to be honest, but...
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I would have picked Wokes, but...
We're back to the same old problem of like my number eight is not going to be a number eight, so maybe I would have picked Wokes, but yeah.
Phil?
Well, I mean, my 12 is very similar to his.
Where does it differ?
It differs only with the wicketkeeper. So I've got Folks in at seven. Bairstow still at the IPL. This is for the first test match. This is not for six test matches. This is for the first test match only. Bairstow's at the IPL, and according to Yorkshire, as far as they know, he's coming back at the end of Punjab's... Yeah.
Well done.
the end of Punjab's campaign. They may yet still... They're outsiders, but they may still yet qualify for the last four. But even so, he won't be back until the third week, well into the third week of May... Even if they don't make it through, that gives him one game if he jumps off the plane straight onto the pitch, but probably
that's
not.
That's a big if.
Yeah, it's a big if. So almost certainly no cricket at all before that first test. Even if he was playing one game, for me, that's not enough. Even if he goes out there and hits 70, 80 odd in that one game, that's not enough. We can't preach Red Bull form and then ignore it, or rather ignore those who have acquired it in favour of somebody who hasn't played it at all. However, obviously you disagree because you picked the team. So you tell me why that's wrong.
I don't think England are in any position that they can not pick a bloke who scored two test hundreds in his last four games. The first of those test hundreds, he'd played one test prior to that, but he hadn't played much Red Bull cricket for a long time before that. So there is evidence to suggest that Bairstow can come in relatively cold and score runs. There is an issue at play, certainly, of like rewarding someone who hasn't been around at all, and Folks has been scoring runs in county cricket. That's part of my
position.
And I do understand that, absolutely. But I'm looking at England's problems previously, and I'm looking at the bowlers that I've selected, and I just need the player who I think is going to score most runs at seven, and for me that is Bairstow. And I don't think Folkes' keeping, whilst it is definitely better, is so significantly better that it sways it that way. I'm not that fussed about that angle. I understand the issue of not having played county cricket and being jetted straight in, but all the noises that Stokes has made as well, I'm just picking my best 11. I'm just picking my best side. And I wouldn't be at all surprised, even if Bairstow has not faced a red ball before that first test, which, you know, well, that is what's going to be the case if he does get picked. I still think he might well go with him, because I just think England are more likely to win test matches with Bairstow at seven than Folkes at seven.
And you know that I think that too. yeah. And indeed, we had this conversation a couple of weeks ago.
I think it might have been you that actually changed my mind, and now you've gone back.
So you'd have Bairstow in the side as soon as he's played a game or two, basically.
When's that going to happen?
Form dependent, but yeah.
Where is the white ball summer by that stage, aren't we?
I think if you're looking at 10 test matches, who's your keeper bat at seven, you know, given a fair wind, then I'd fancy that Bairstow would catch just about as many balls as Folkes and score more runs than Folkes in all conditions. That's my feeling. I think that's the best use of Bairstow. If Butler's not going to be in the side, then that's how I would be tempted to use him. But it's not a fair wind as it stands. Folkes have started the season well. I understand that Stokes will be saying, I just want my best team. But I can't say with any assurance that Bairstow makes the best team when he's been in the IPL, not scoring runs in the IPL, by the way. So he's not in form. He's made 150 in about seven or eight knocks. In a team that's not gone great, and he's been struggling, so I don't think there's any guarantee. This is not purely a moral question. This is also based on, everybody knows that unless you're Rohit Sharma, it is difficult. It's difficult
he's
to move.
No, he's having a difficult IPL as well.
Right. Well, probably because he's a test player. But yeah, it's just a big ask. Whoever you are, if you're Bradman, it's a big ask. If you're Sobers, it's a big ask to just jump off the plane and then revert back to Red Bull cricket against a very, very good side in early season conditions. So it's a two-pronged argument for me. That's why Folkes gets the gig for the start of this series. I hope Folkes doesn't nail it down. You know, I like the aesthetic of Folkes being a top-class number seven keeper bat. And then Bairstow can come in as an argument for number five, for sure. But at the minute, no, not for me. You cannot play the thing until the very, very last second and then Chris Gayle it and then just stroll back in to a Lords test match. I just don't, I'm not having that personally.
Oh, I think the Stokes and Bairstow bat so well together as well. I think that six and seven, I think that could be really, really exciting. Yeah. Now we know that Stokes is coming to six.
So same bowlers, Robinson, Mahmood, Anderson, Parkinson, Broad. Just want to say on Parkinson versus Leach, I know we're all team Parkinson here, but I think part of it for me is that Parkinson's contributing pretty much every time he bowls for Lancashire, and Leach hasn't done great this season. He's bowled 54 overs, got three wickets at 42. We'll see what the side balance is, and I know that Parkinson's not a great bat, but Leach is no more than a number 10 as well. And I think if you've got four bowlers, you don't need a spinner who's better at containing. You want someone who goes out there, kind of like what Adil Rashid did in 2018. I think Parkinson's your man to do that. He's got more experience over his whole career, but more recent experience of bowling on really flat wickets, spectate wickets throughout the 4 days than Leach does. So I think
I've watched quite a lot of Jack Leach this year, and obviously Somerset played here. And it's confirmed again what he offers, especially at this time of year, especially on these kinds of decks. If you have a combination of these bowlers that we've mentioned, you know, who, if you have a combination of Robinson, Anderson, Broad, plus Quick, possibly an Overton in there, then they are all back of a length, 2.5 and over type bowlers. Stokes might come in there and try and force the issue a little bit. To have another containing, functional cement mixer style bowler, that would just be madness to me.
I agree. Top seven, I've gone Lees and Sibley up top. Crawley at three, despite what I said on last week's show. Crawley's actually got a pretty good record at three, but I've got him in at three, partly because I wasn't really sure who else there was. I'm not yet sold on Bohannon. go back to it. He's only scored 4 first class hundreds. He's 25. I think that's a risk.
He's the biggest punt in my 11. He was the last person to pick, and the reason really is because he's used to batting 3, and that feels more and more like a specialist position when you look at the stroke makers that fill the middle order. You know, it would be tempting to throw in, right, well, Ollie Pope, for instance. I think Ollie Pope should be batting 3 for Surrey. I think he just scores runs with funds in county cricket. I think he should make it not only more challenging for himself to get him ready for Test cricket, but also that, I think, is the position where he can be most valuable to England going forward. I think an Ollie Pope in form has the game for that role. If he's not going to bat 3 for Surrey, I don't want to push him up from 5 for Surrey to bat him 3 in Test cricket when he hasn't nailed Test cricket by any means over the last year.
I've picked him at 5 ahead of Brook. Very, okay. Very close, but kind of want Brook to just do it for a little bit longer. He's done brilliantly so far this season, definitely, but he has probably batted against the 3 weakest attacks in Division 1 in the first 3 games, and that Essex game was extremely high scoring. So yeah, I want to see Pope get one more go now, I think.
But is this not the best? When is there a better time to pick Brook? And to be honest, I'm kind of parroting what you said a few weeks back, that he's not, given his how good he is at white ball cricket, he's probably not going to get this extended run of red ball cricket at the start of the summer in future years. This is the regeneration of a new side. He's a hugely exciting young cricketer. He fits the bill entirely for what Stokes has been talking about. If we don't pick him now, then I'm not really sure there's going to be a better time to bring him in than at the start of the home summer. I know what you're saying about the attacks, but it's the manner he's dealt with those attacks. I mean, his strike rate. Like, I mean, one concern is that he's playing so fluently. Will he be able to rein it in and play in a different manner? But he got 150, 160 off about 230 balls or something like that. So he's not just come out and whacked it. He has shown that adaptability. I think he's one of those kind of rare occasions where his form is so good, I think you have to pick him.
Yeah, down. I don't really disagree with that. I guess it's more that I look at Pope and think, he should have cracked Test cricket. It's not quite working. I really want to know that it's not going to work for the time being before that decision is made. But I think what we all agree on, which I don't think will actually happen, is that one of Folks and Bairstow won't play. I think they will pick both of them, with Bairstow at 5, probably with Folks with the gloves, is what I'd probably predict. I've just gone Bairstow. Bairstow, for me, definitely would be in the team if he's played lots of cricket. But I completely get your point, but I've still kept him in there.
Well, one we haven't really mentioned is Milan, who was,
yeah, who Butch does mention it, by the way.
Does he?
Yeah, he's who Butch, okay, would have, so the team.
I really ummed and ahed on that one, and I think just for the sense of the wanting that sort of shock of the new of having the two most interesting young county batters in there at 3 and 5 in Bohannon and Brook. But you know, if I had to pick this team, I would probably pick Milan at 3, who's started the season very well. He was unlucky to miss out on the West Indies tour. Now, admittedly, he fell away in Australia, but again, there was this off the field stuff that he was having to deal with as well. He started very well again for Yorkshire. He's a machine at county level.
Although again, he's not batting 3, and I'm not saying that means he shouldn't bat 3 in Test cricket, but George Hill's been batting 3. Milan's been coming 4, even 5 when Root was playing last time. I would like to see more of these Test aspirant players or guys who want to try and get back in and are the option at number 3, because, you know, Root's batting 4, Stokes batting 6. You're looking at 3 or 5. If you're an option for number 3, I think you should bat number 3 for your county.
Yeah, I hear that. But I would just say, in Milan's case, he's 34-5. He's been around the block. He's played a lot of cricket at 3. This time last year, he was making runs for fun at 3, came back into the England side at 3, did okay at 3, did well at 3, really, for the first 3 or 4 Test matches. And looked like he had the tempo to play that role. I understand, ideally, you'd have your right people in your right places.
I'm not so fussed about Milan batting 3 or 4. It just struck me that, you know, if that's the position you want to bat, I would, and I'm saying this more from Pope, especially Amla's not looking a great touch at all for Surrey.
But I think Brook, it's a case that is inarguable now, I think. As Joe says, when you have a player that is that sparkling, and it's not just that he's had a good month, he had a good year, he had a really good year last year, he's had a good winter. they clearly like him, and he fulfills the components of what Stokes is looking for, and he's averaging literally 158 or whatever it is, with 300s in four games. Now has to be the time at the start of this new cycle to have a look at the kid. It doesn't mean that Pope will play a lot of test matches for England again, for sure. But for me at the moment, Brook is a stick-on in that middle order. And you fit one or two others around that.
Billy asks, what represents genuine success for the England test side over the summer? A win?
It's good. The first thing, yeah, win a match. That'd be a good start. It's a really good and difficult question to answer, yeah, because the challenges arriving are going to be really difficult. They'd be really difficult if England had good form going into this summer. You know, I think they should still... South Africa have been resurgent recently, but that is still... You look at the 11, it is still not a great South African side. England should be beating South Africa on home soil, really. So I think a win over South Africa... And they should really be beating this New Zealand side as well.
If England... They can take a 1-1 against New Zealand and shake hands on that. If they don't beat South Africa, it's poor form. This South African side is...
It's a decent... They just beat India. Decent. It's a good side. Yeah, they drew in New Zealand.
It's sprightly, and they always find players, and they always maintain a bit of spirit. Harmer will be playing, you assume, although he can't buy a wicket, as I said earlier. Keegan Peterson is, you know, playing at Durham at three. He's come through. There are players there in South Africa, but still, this is nowhere near the side of the past. England have lost one series at home in the best part of a decade.
This
or whatever
is it. This is what you've got to remember.
And that was a two-test series last year, and they were even up in that game against New Zealand. They were up in that Edgbaston game until they got blown away on the third afternoon. And there's what is it, 8 years, 9 years, the one series they've lost at home. So if they go in there and they lose either of these series, then it's a bad summer.
And for some of that period, they were a very, very good side. For a lot of that period, they weren't that good, and they still managed to win at home. So this is what England need to get back to. We're not expecting them to go abroad and beat, you know, Pakistan in October. The expectations will be completely different, but we have to get back to a point where the England test team wins basically a series when they play at home.
Mm. Moving on to the IPL. The two new sides, Lucknow Super Giants and the Gujarat Titans, are currently top of the table with 8 wins each from 11 games. Daniel Sams defended 9 from the final over of Mumbai's game against Gujarat with David Miller, Rahul Tawati and Rashid Khan at the crease. He conceded just 3 to win the game for Mumbai. That was only Mumbai's second win in the tournament. They're 2 from 11. Bester has found some form. He hit his first 50 in the competition the other day, having returned to the top of the order for Punjab. But the standout moment for me was that Umran Malik clocked 97.5 miles per hour, which they don't have publicly available data for every IPL season, but for all the seasons that they do, that goes back to, I think, 2010 or 2011, that is the fastest ball ever bowled in the IPL.
Yeah, that's proper wheels. you mentioned Mumbai. Still, though, I saw the game yesterday against KKR. And it's miserable to watch them. I mean,
Bumrah took 5 for 10.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say.
Actually, other than that,
Bumrah was phenomenal, and yet they still got 165 odd KKR, and Bumrah took 5 for 10 in four overs, and then they were all out for 100 and something, 110, 112, something like that. And again, I said it a few weeks ago. The motif of the IPL for this year is Kyron Pollard being unable to hit it off the square, going at a run of ball. And it was quite agonising to watch them again, really.
The Fairbreak Invitational kicked off last week. There have been some amazing moments that you might have seen on social media. I spoke to Georgie Heath, who's out there at the moment, about some of those moments and the tournament in general so far.
At the time of recording, we are 9 matches into the Fairbreak Invitational out in Dubai. We're joined once more by Georgie Heath, who's out there. How has it gone so far?
I think as much as I was mega excited beforehand, it's kind of gone beyond any expectations even I had. The reach it seems to be having, the stories that are coming out of it, the cricket performances. We had 100 in the first game. We've had a fiver in the most recent game. We've had players from associate nations going viral with celebrations. We've had fourfers from Japanese cricketers. Honestly, it's the kind of stuff you can't write. And I feel like this is the sort of tournament that is only going to bring those kind of stories, and it's just incredible to be a part of it, really, I think.
I mean, you said last time that part of the tournament's charm, and you said there again, would be seeing players from associate nations rub shoulders and hold their own against players from, you know, England, Australia, South Africa. And that's happened. There have been some amazing moments. 40-year-old Japan bowler Shizuka Miyagi took a four for my favourite moment of the tournament, and I think a lot of others as well, would be Rwanda's Henriette Ishimwe taking clean bowling Australia World Cup winner Nicola Carey. She's just 19. That's happened. What other moments have stood out for you, and other players from associate nations have stood out for you?
Oh, you can't really look past Winnie Durasingham playing for the Tornadoes from Malaysia. And she's just one of those people. She's just such a beautiful being as well. And the kind of person you'd almost find, even if you were playing against her, you want her to do well, because she's just that kind of person. And when she got her 3 for 24 the other day, you could hear everyone just chanting, "Watch for Winnie," because they get their Apple Watch as the player of the match award. And she's just one of those people. She's just dedicates herself so much. But how much do you ever hear about Malaysian cricket? And she's just such a character, and she's really sort of coming into her own. But then there's people who are, you know, they're there and you haven't really noticed. So we saw in the last Barmy Army game, obviously you've got big name Deandra Dottin, world boss, absolutely bish-bash boshing it. Kavisha at the other end, UAE player, she was more than up to the challenge of Dottin, and she was out hitting her at some times. And that's the kind of thing you'd never even know what kind of sixes she can hit, what kind of player she is. And they're there on an even keel, and it was just amazing to see.
So what do you think happens next to a player like Ishimwe, in that this is an amazing opportunity to show how she can do against some of the best players in the world, but there aren't enough tournaments out there like this. If she goes back to playing for only Rwanda are quite a long way from qualifying for an ICC World Cup. A lot of criticism of ICC Men's World Cups not being big enough. ICC Women's World Cups are often even smaller. So what happens next for these players? Because as amazing as this tournament is, there aren't any tournaments like it.
Yeah, I think that is very difficult, because obviously this is giving them that coverage and that, you know, bringing it to the world. And I think that is the part of it. You know, it is being streamed in so many places for free, and those nations are seeing it. So it's about building on that story. She's one player, and then you've got to look ahead to the next fair break, all fingers crossed. But you know, I'm very confident, if I'm honest, that there will be another, because the success it's already been. So it's building on the next one and having two Rwandans or three or four in the next. And you know, we say it so often, see it to be it, and that's the kind of thing. They can see Rwandan female cricketers doing what she's doing and igniting a tournament like this. That's the kind of thing that you can't ignore as part of a cricket organisation in her country. And it's bringing in the money, bringing in the coverage to give her that ability to grow as a player, but also nurturing others to get to that position.
How are the players finding it, both those associate nations and those from the bigger nations, in inverted commas?
I think they're absolutely loving it. What's really great is that, you know, beforehand people are like, the associate nation players, and I really hate that sometimes people sounded a bit patronising. It's like, can learn from the big name, which is what we say, and that's, you know, we've got World Cup winners. You can't deny that. We've got World Cup winning captains playing, but they're all learning from each other in opposite ways. You know, there are some people who've come through, and we've got Anju Gurung. She, during the pandemic, was training in the streets in Bhutan, you know, and that's the kind of thing you think, it's their commitment that the bigger players see. You know, we've been handed a lot of things on a plate. They really are starting to appreciate the game more, and also almost finding that sort of raw love for it that they've always had, rather than just being in this intense situation. Like, some of them have come off the back of the World Cup, you know, so intense, only your team, all about that. And I think they're rediscovering their love for the game of cricket, and perhaps picking up different things that they might not have thought of, because it's not traditional cricket to them. But then obviously you've got the associate nations who are looking, players from there looking at the World Cup winners, this, that and the other, and then learning from them as well. So they're all just bouncing off each other, and it's really nice. It's got such a nice energy around it. And even around the hotel, players from different nations, different teams, you know, you've got some players who are 18, 19, and then you've got 34, 35, 40-year-old Japanese players, and they're all just living life together. And it's so nice to see.
You mentioned a few names there. Are there any other players who've stood out for you?
You know what? There are certain players who aren't necessarily associate players that you can't ignore. We can't not talk about Ayabonga Kaka's five for the other day. That was just that was pace bowling at some of its finest. And you would see that, you'd be impressed by that at a World Cup, you'd be impressed by that anywhere. So that was world-class level cricket there. But then we've got youngsters coming through. You know, we've got the likes of Jade Allen. She's only 19, from Australia. She played her first game the other day. It was great there. Gabby Lewis, looking here from Ireland. Her and Elise Fellaini had that insane opening stand. You've got Mughal from UAE. She's really solid in those middle overs. And that's the kind of person who doesn't get that coverage that, it's not the glittering wickets at every other ball, but she's there and thereabouts. Carrie Chan from Hong Kong. Such a personality on and off the field. She was almost on with the belly dancers yesterday. She's that kind of person, but she brings that energy to the field, and that's what you want as well. So yeah, it's just a bit of everything, really. Don't know. And then you can't ignore the celebrations that have been going on everywhere. We've had the pushbur, we've got tornadoes. Diana Baig is loving her tornado celebration. The Barmies were doing the dancing. Yeah, it's all going. We've got a falcon somewhere.
How does the format work? Because I think we're at exactly halfway through the group stage at the moment. Everyone's played three matches, just after halfway. How does the format work?
Yeah, so each team plays each other once, and then there's obviously the bonus point involved in the run scoring in the first 10 overs. So there's a maximum of 4 points per game you can get. So that will be, that should come into play when it looks later, and like if it's not just outright straight to the semis, whatever. And then we'll have two semi-finals, and then there's the final and third place playoff on Sunday the 15th.
What have you made of the bonus points? It's not something we often see in T20 tournaments, but I kind of think that when you look at a table in T20 cricket and teams have played three games, they've won two games, lost one, and they're all on the same number of points. And the thing that's distinguishing them is net run rate, that you know roughly how it works, but you don't know exactly, you can't get your head around exactly how it works. How do you think that the bonus points have worked?
You know what, if it comes to simplifying maths, I am all for it. I'm not about that run rate life. There's far too many confusing decimals for me. So I think it's great. And also, it adds a kind of extra little something, whether they're going to think, okay, is this game away from us? And are we just going to go for that extra point? We know we're going to lose, but we're still going to get a point out of it. Like, when you were really young and you played tournaments, whatever, and it was like, if you get half their runs, you get an extra point just because, But I think it works really well because it does add a little thinking about it. And we were watching the other day and we were like, are they just going to start really hitting at this point, or are they going to try and do the run chase? But the run chase was out of their grasp, really. So yeah, it's nice because it adds a little extra thing there. And then looking later to the semis, it's like, right, actually, we really were quite tactical and clever with that. We knew we'd lost it. We got that point in the bag. That was good work from us in those 10 overs there. So I think it's a really good addition to it, actually. Nice. Although I get very confused when people are figuring out how many runs it is. I just wait for someone to tell me.
Yeah, I mean, look at your table now. You've got four teams who have played 3-1-2. And quite often I think that playing for net run rate can actually lead to some really, really boring cricket. If one team is miles ahead in the game, the other team is just trying to not get absolutely smashed. And that's not actually that entertaining. I've actually really liked it, and it'll be interesting to see if more tournaments take Fair Break's lead and implement a similar system. Well, Georgie, once more, thanks for your time. It sounds amazing. We're very jealous.
I hope everyone's enjoying it back in England as well, and you enjoy my dulcet tones. I like to whip a dad joke in there every so often as well.
fantastic. Well, thanks again for your time, Georgie, and see you soon.
One question to finish off the show. Alec asks, a slightly silly one from me this week. We all love cricket, but what in the game don't you give a toss about? For me, it's the six distance measurement. The RPL commentators are obsessed with this and ram it down your throat every time. They even have a bigger six of the year table. It doesn't matter. I literally don't care if it's been hit 65 metres or 115 metres. It's still six runs. You don't get any more runs for it, so I just don't care. There are enough important stats and numbers in the game. We don't need irrelevant ones. Keep up the great work. Cheers, Alec. That's a great question.
It's a very good point as well. I also think I've heard that those are quite unreliable, those stats.
Blatantly. Okay. Yeah. Blatantly.
Definitely don't have a tape measure. Joe, do you want to kick us off?
I've got a couple that I'm slightly reluctant to say because I feel like I'm going to get cancelled by various different people in different... But the first is the 2022 IPL. I just just hasn't got me this year. The new teams threw me to start with. Too many players shifting sides, too much other cricket, just completely passed me by. And I'm aware that for a lot of people it matters quite a lot. So I'm not saying it doesn't matter, because it does.
And you're specifically talking about this year's IPL rather than
last
IPL
year. I got really into it. The year before, I think, as well.
The year before, there was literally no cricket on at all in a global pandemic. So
that might have had something
to do with
it.
You were well into that one.
Last year's one as well, to be honest, as well. Yeah. Anything else other than...
Well, this one I think is going to upset people in this room as much as people listening at home. I don't care what bats players use. I used to as a kid. I'm not bothered now.
Heresy!
And when I hear these conversations now, I mean, probably less so. You and Ben aren't so much into that, are you?
No, I'm not huge. I used to be massively so when I was a kid. So I had Gunnar Moores because Vaughan had a Gunnar Moore and Triscothic had a Gunnar Moore.
Well, I knew this was, so really, yeah, Phil's obviously now denigrating me as a player
because I've made this comment.
You care what bats players have now?
Well, I mean, not as much as I used to, but it's still...
So you're excited about Pope's move from Gunnar Moore to Gray Nicholls? Is that?
Yeah, I was actually. Yeah, exactly. I was, because I thought, right, okay, here we go. He's really stepping up now.
But Burns was another Gray Nicholls signing, wasn't he?
Yeah. Also, Johnny Bairstow changed bat sponsors about six times. Changed one a year, which is always a sign of somebody with a keen interest in their bank balance.
Can you name all of them?
I probably could, actually. In fact, I was struck watching one yesterday because he was using a Gray Nicholls power spot, an old school Gray Nicholls power spot, in a game that I watched last night. My wife was out, don't get me wrong. Lancashire Yorkshire from 2015 in a T20 knockout game or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Ollie Robinson was playing that game. They showed this on Sky the other day.
Ollie Robinson?
Yeah, he was.
Matt Fisher was playing in it. This is what struck me. 2015, Matt Fisher was playing. It literally would have been, 17 or... But anyway, Bairstow was using a Gray Nicholls power spot at the time, having just moved from Slazenger.
This is exactly what I'm talking about.
Now, of course, he's at Tun. But he's had a few others. Well, yeah. That's scandalous.
There are two.
Phil, anything you don't care about?
Joe, what don't I care about?
Wicketkeepers. Phil doesn't care about wicketkeepers.
What do you mean you don't care about wicketkeepers?
I just don't care about wicketkeepers.
What do you mean?
I think it's because I don't understand what they do from a technical perspective, particularly. So I don't really. I'm not moved by wicketkeepers.
But it's
I'm not especially impressed by wicketkeepers.
Well, even when they're standing up to a spinner and it's ragging.
Well, I know that it's good skills. You know, fair play to you. Fair play to you. But I guess it's because I've never done it, so I've got no frame of reference.
Yeah,
and so. And also, they're kind of often sort of crabby, perky characters concealing all kinds of, sort of peculiar self-doubt and so on. But, you know, they have to maintain a sort of rhythm for the team. That irritates me as well. They're kind of like the heartbeat of the team. That always gets on my nerves. I've got no interest in goalkeeping. I've got no interest in wicketkeeping either.
Anyone in gloves?
Anyone in gloves, Gardeners? Really. Well, I've actually... recently acquired a garden and I bought some gloves and I'm actually quite enjoying it. So maybe it's not just simply a glove thing, Joe.
Maybe this is the start of an appreciation of glove work in general.
Anyway, that's cancelled me part one. What we got? What's next?
Yeah, has you got anything? But you love it. You love it all. This is the thing.
I don't care for sight screens. You get rid of sight screens. It really
that's
irritates me when a batsman asks to move the sight screen because you see me bat. I'm not great. I've never noticed a sight screen when I'm batting. That's potentially where I'm going wrong. But I just cannot believe that it makes a difference, particularly at a recreational level, when the sight screens are tiny anyway.
Yeah,
I think it's one of those things, and maybe this is a more general irritation, so it's not quite I don't care, is club cricketers like almost behaving like professionals. Come on. The bowling's 55 miles per hour at best.
I hate second team fielding practice. There was sort of reluctant fielding practice beforehand. Totally indifferent to that. No need for it. Nets generally.
Indoor nets.
Yeah. Correction. Joe is right. Indoor nets, awful.
Utterly soulless.
Yeah.
And no reflection of anything that's going to happen on a field ever.
Pretty much every Twitter culture war through the prism of some cricketing niche event. Can't stand it. Mancads. Don't care one way or the other. Have your opinions. Fine. Whatever. Don't care.
Now we've got you going. You've got quite a
discourse around the 100. You know, clearly it's not a binary issue, is it? That. when the ICC turn up in England and they completely emblazon grounds just with their own advertisers, that gets on my nerves.
Yeah. Well, the Hampshire Bowl.
So that is something you give a toss about.
We're asking for indifference rather than anger, isn't it?
Yeah. Now you're just doing things that annoy you in cricket and the wider life.
Yeah, no, I'm going to get going there. All right, let's leave that alone. No, again, I was going to say cricket and poetry gets on my nerves. But it's not about what gets on my nerves. Forget it.
Anyway. I think that'll do. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Joe. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. Well done for getting to the end of the show. We'll be back next week. Podcast Network.